Content warning. The following podcast contains information that may be harmful or traumatizing to some audiences.
Welcome to Tales from Weber, a podcast where we talk about some of the lesser known stories of Weber County's history. We draw not only from the written history books, but also the newspapers, materials available to us at Weber State University Special Collections. I am your host and storyteller, Sarah Langston. By day, I am the head of Special Collections, and the rest of the time, I consider myself an enthusiastic historian of Weber County. We started this podcast to shed light on the interesting history of the area and not just repeat the same stories that have been told before. So sit back and relax as we stroll through the history of Weber County. In this episode, we will examine the brutal murder of Louise Jepson and the events leading up to her death. Before we take a deep dive, let's look at what was going on in the world at the time of her murder in 1934. Well, the United States is in the middle of the Great Depression. The stock market crashed in 1929 and plunged the economy into a downward spiral. People are spending less and failing companies are laying off workers left and right. By 1933, over 15 million Americans are unemployed, and nearly half of the banks in the United States have failed. Utah isn't faring better, as much of the economy is still focused on agriculture. In 1920, women had been given the right to vote, and many were entering the workforce. Unfortunately, they were only given low-wage jobs and still involved in what we call women's work, like domestic service, teaching, and clerical work. They were employed by new technologies such as telephone companies. Interestingly enough, the Great Depression didn't affect women's jobs as much. In fact, the employment rate for women from 1930 to 1940 raised over 24%. So this is the world that Louise Jepson was living in. She was born in 1910 in Logan, Utah. She was the youngest of the children to parents Severine and Emma Jepson, immigrants from Sweden. The family had moved to Ogden after the death of her father in 1921. Her oldest brother was the vice president of a bank in town. Louise was living with her mother at 2527 Brinker. She was a graduate from Ogden High School and had been employed as a telephone operator at the Ogden Standard Examiner for several years. In May of 1934, she took a six-week vacation to find a job in California. While there, she was promised the position as a hostess aboard a Madsen Company liner. She was living with some people from Utah who were responsible for taking care of her. She was found dead in Golden State Park early in the morning on May 13, 1934, in the south tunnel of the old stadium. She was originally listed as Jane Doe, as she had no identification on her. The cause of her death was listed as strangulation. So exactly how did Louise end up dead in the park? Let's examine this case. Louise came to California and stayed in a hotel for the first 2 weeks as she began looking for a job. When the money ran out, she reached out to a couple from Ogden that now lived in San Francisco, Mr. and Mrs. Hushies. They offered her a place to stay as she continued to look for work. After her murders, the Hushies described Louise as a party girl. She often had callers coming to the house, but never introduced them, and would not return home until 1 or 2 a.m. The Hushies said she left at 4 p.m. on Saturday and never returned home. She did not tell them where she was going. So into this story enters Millard Hickman. He was a 45-year-old superintendent of engineers at the Madsen Navigation Company and was also a separated father of two young girls. Hickman first met Louise on May 8th at the Madsen docks. They went for drinks, and then he took her home, but then called on her again at 9 p.m. and took her to his place before going to the beach for sandwiches. He ended up taking her home at 1 a.m. She did not accept any of his advances he tried. Hickman's wife was divorcing him and charged him with cruelty and infidelity. She said he struck her and beat her, was cold and indifferent, and staying out late and sometimes all night with all manners of people. Flash forward 4 days to May 12th. On May 12th, Hickman picked up Louise at 3 p.m. They went back to his apartment and she made them dinner, and they had drinks with Thomas E. D., president of the Thomas D. Engineering Company, and Blanche McKay. So when I first researched this story, I got a little confused because Ogden, of course, was home to Thomas D. D., who was employed with the D. Construction Company, and as well as the McKay Hospital. And Blanche McKay, there was also a McKay family here with David O. McKay. So I was a little confused as to whether or not these were Ogden people or not, and it turns out they were not the same, just same names. So the four of them finished dinner about 10 p.m., and they sat around drinking and talking. At midnight, they decided to go to a nightclub and remained there until the club closed at 1 a.m. Louise had been drinking so much, she passed out before they left. Thomas and Millard picked her up and put her in Hickman's car, and they took her back to Hickman's apartment, where he took her in and put her in his bed. McKay and Dee immediately left and went home. Hickman tried to make her more comfortable by taking off her shoes. Louise did not like that at all, and her and Hickman argued. Hickman said she got up and dressed and left alone. He did not go after her or offer to take her home or call a cab. At 6 o'clock that morning, Louise's body was found by John Gentry, a stableman who was walking to work. He saw the body and hurried to the Park Police Station to tell authorities. He said, quote, "I walked slowly towards the body and saw her face covered with blood. Her head was lying in a pool of blood." When the police arrived and examined the body, they found that she had been strangled with her own scarf and severely beaten. There was evidence of a blow on her right temple and another one behind her left ear. Her clothing was torn and she had been assaulted. It looked like she had been attacked at the mouth of the tunnel and then dragged to the middle of the tunnel and left for dead. She had been attacked after she was unconscious. There was broken shrubbery and scuffed dirt that had shown that it was a terrible struggle. As they were examining her body, they noticed her shoes were stamped inside with her name, Louise Jepson. However, at the time, they did not know that was her name. Photographs of Louise's body ran in the paper, and she was identified the next morning by Miss Kathleen Shufflebarger of Ogden, who was in town visiting friends. She had known Louise from high school, and she rushed to the morgue and identified the body. Hickman was charged with criminally assaulting Louise and strangling her to death with her own scarf. The elevator operator in Hickman's apartment said he saw him leave with Jepson at 3 a.m., less than 2 hours before she was killed. The garage attendant had said he was almost sure that Hickman's car had left at 3 a.m. In the park, tire prints were found that were similar to the tires on Hickman's car. There was red dust on the tires of Hickman's car that resembled that of the park roadways, and an unexplained cut on his hand and bruises on his legs. There was a flashlight on the seat of his car that would have been heavy enough to cause the wounds to her head. Hickman claimed that he had called Blanche McKay back to his room after Louise left, and she arrived at 4 a.m. She spent the rest of the night with him. The two and Thomas D. and another woman, Marjorie May, were yachting when Hickman was arrested. Blanche McKay testified that she spent the night with Hickman. She said, quote, "I am willing to sacrifice my good name and reputation to save an innocent man from the gallows." The newspapers characterized Blanche McKay as simply the alibi girl. Louise's brother, Severin, who was a banker, immediately came to San Francisco when they were informed of her death. He said he hoped whoever did this would hang and that he himself was permitted to help. He said, quote, "I'll track down this murderer and kill him if it's the last act of my life." He saw Hickman's car and said that that was enough evidence to convince him of Hickman's guilt. When questioned by the police about Louise being addicted to alcohol, He said she drank, but occasionally, like most modern girls did. The family had sent a Mother's Day telegram to Louise, but it had been returned undeliverable the day she was murdered. Louise's brother questioned why the Hushies did not report her missing that morning. The trial happened pretty immediately in July. When witnesses were called, there was a streetcar driver who said he was driving and he could hear the screams of a woman early in the morning through the park, but did not investigate. Another one said he saw her get on a streetcar and get off at the park and walk through it alone early in the morning. She had hairs in her hands, but those did not match Hickman's. The police, upon further investigation, found that the tire marks did not match, and the stains on Hickman's clothing were not blood, but actually paint. When questioned on the stand, the doorman admitted he wasn't 100% sure of the time Hickman came and left, and it could have been 30 minutes earlier or later. Hickman said she had left alone after repulsing his advances a third time and had a vengeful sweetheart who frequently threatened her life. The defense said that they could produce three other women who admitted to being assaulted in the park. The defense said Jepson had dyed her hair red and become a San Francisco, quote, party girl. So let's talk a little bit about what a party girl was. In the 1930s, the definition of a party girl was a young woman who was a keen and frequent party goer, one with a hedonistic lifestyle. She liked to pursue her pleasures, specifically a prostitute. A matter of fact, in 1930, there was a film that came out called Party Girl, which was about an escort agency that caters to high-class playboys. It was interesting when researching this story that there was no mention in the Utah papers about Jepson being a party girl or dyeing her hair red. They painted her very much as a sweet, young, innocent Mormon girl who had left Utah and gone to the big city and met her unfortunate end. It was only the San Francisco papers that painted her as the party girl. The Hushies even said she went out every night and never mentioned any of the men she went to see. During the trial, the jury was taken to the tunnel to examine the place of her death and to be told the story there. Defense said they had an idea who did it and that the prosecution was just trying to pin it on Hickman. The trial was over in just a few short days. When the jury went out for deliberation, they were only gone for an hour and 49 minutes. Most everyone had left to go have dinner, including Louise's family. Her brother and his wife and her older sister and husband were in town for the trial. Louise's mother was far too ill to travel, so she was unable to make it. The family was out at dinner when the jury went to deliberate, and they were not expecting such a quick judgment. When the jury came back, just those less than two hours later, Hickman was found not guilty. It turns out that the first vote was 11-1 in favor of not guilty, and that after dinner and talking, the one holdout didn't have any further reservations, and they acquitted Hickman. Hickman, upon his acquittal, said he was going to go fishing immediately after and didn't know when he would return. He was just trying to get away and forget what happened. Louise's family, upon hearing the verdict, went to the Hushies' home and were in complete shock and not knowing what had really happened to their sister. So just 2 days after Hickman was acquitted, a new suspect emerged on the scene. On July 26th, Albert Boyer, who was a U.S. Army private, had become a suspect in Louise's murder. He was a man Louise had met at a nightclub, but had often broken dates with him, as she was very fearful of him. She had known him in Ogden, and he had wanted to renew their friendship. She said she was too afraid to go out with him, so she broke the date. The man was insanely jealous of her. The morning after Louise's murder, he had appeared with an injured hand and blood spots on his clothing. He said, quote, "I got in a quarrel with a girl and had to smack her down." He immediately disappeared from San Francisco and the police could not find him. It took them well over 3 weeks before he finally came back into town. It turns out that Boyer had run off and gotten married and was off living with his new bride. He said that the injury to his hand he had received in the line of duty before the murder, and the police had to exonerate him based on the evidence. So there was little or no movement on Louise's murder case until 2 years later. In 1936, Albert Walker walked into the police station one morning and turned himself in for killing a nurse. He had said he had met Blanche Cousins, who was from Idaho, on a bus when she got on in Salt Lake City. They had spent the entire time between Salt Lake City and San Francisco talking, and he had invited her back to his place for the evening. He said that, quote, "he started to make violent love to her and started to choke her with his hands. He didn't know if she was dead or not, so he took her stockings and tied them around her neck and tied it to a bedpost to strangle her." He had been in San Francisco, it turns out, during the time of Louise's murder, but denied the murder. Blanche also had red hair. The police could not find any evidence connecting Albert to Louise's murder, even though he confessed to the strangulation of Blanche. So to this date, Louise's murder has remained unsolved. Her body was prepared for burial and brought back by her brother to be buried in Logan, and she was buried next to her father. So, thank you for joining me on this episode of Tales from Weber. I have been your host, Sarah Langston. This podcast has been generously funded by the Friends of the Stewart Library, a group of community members that are passionate about libraries and the history of the surrounding area. If you are interested in learning more about this group, please visit the Stewart Library's website at library.weber.edu. Please join us again as we continue to explore the history of Weber County.